Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Simply Safe, and I do want to talk about that because I just installed that in my house. Our guest today is Norm Orenstein from AEI, a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing editor to The Atlantic. So welcome up to the Bulwark Podcast, Norm.
It's great to be with you, Charlie.
Now, are you like the official token lefty at AEI?
I'm a resident scholar, not a visiting scholar. So I've been here longer, believe it or not, than anybody else. But I don't call myself a lefty. I long ago adopted the term that you are probably familiar with of raging moderate. But I have long been a little bit different than many of my colleagues, put it that way.
Okay, so you had an early book in the Trump administration, One Nation After Trump. We're still waiting for After Trump. And any indication when we're going to get to After Trump, since you wrote the book about it?
I'd like to mention the subtitle, which I'm very proud of. It's A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported.
Covers us all.
Yeah, it was hopeful in a way, but I don't have any idea. And I would say a couple of things about that. The first is, given the nature of the Electoral College and the likelihood that we will have another very fat Russian thumb put on the scales with Mitch McConnell in the Senate refusing to do anything to advance election security, you can easily imagine a scenario where Trump loses the popular vote by 8 million, not the 3 million last time, and still wins a narrow Electoral College majority. At the same time, a lot of people are increasingly worried that if it's a very close election, he simply won't leave. And I can weave a few scenarios there that include Republican governors or legislatures or both saying, we don't believe the results of the election in our state that showed the Democrat winning. So we're going to choose a different competing set of electors. And then the two slates of electors go to Congress on January 6th. You need the House and Senate in agreement on which slate to choose. And if they don't agree, you don't count that state's electoral votes. And that could mean nobody gets a majority, in which case the House would choose a president from the top three electoral vote getters by state. 26 states needed to select a president. And even if Democrats enhance their majority in the House, it's entirely possible that Republican delegations would prevail in 26 or more states. So there are a lot of scenarios that could mean Donald Trump stays in the White House for a considerable period of time, which I believe could be the end of our republic. At the same time, we know that his approval rating has never really gotten above 42%. And I suspect as we go a little bit further along with these proceedings and as we get more revelations, including the one today that should have been clear but now has become more concrete, that he made a lot of calls on
I want to get to that one. So, I mean, I'm listening to your scenario. I'm listening to your scenario about the election and thinking, damn it, Norm, I picked a bad week to quit day drinking. I usually think that I'm the pessimist in the conversation, and you lapped me there. So
that's my job.
Okay, but let's go to my favorite story. I actually have a coin flip of my favorite story of the day. I mean, one is, you know, Rudy Giuliani being in Kyiv or Kiev, however you pronounce it. But this is the story you just mentioned. This is the best, especially for the Hillary emails folks there. Washington Post reporting President Trump has routinely communicated with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and other individuals speaking on cell phones vulnerable to monitoring by Russian and other foreign intelligence services. Current and former U.S. officials said phone records released this week revealed extensive communication between Giuliani, with no indication those calls were encrypted or otherwise shielded from foreign surveillance. The revelation raises the possibility, we can edit that, the absolute certainty that Moscow was able to learn about aspects of Trump's attempt to get Ukraine to investigate a political rival months before that effort was exposed by a whistleblower. So, you know, if irony was not already dead, Norm, it would certainly be dead, because remember what the whole Hillary email thing was about, these unsecured communications. And this story, in great detail, the president apparently does not want to use the landlines because he's afraid that his own aides might be listening in or know who he's calling. So he's making these international calls, or these calls, on a completely unsecured cell phone.
So, as they say, you can't make this stuff up. I would take it even further, Charlie, because we know that Ivanka, Jared, and others have routinely used their private email accounts for official business. So it even gets into emails and into servers. But with these cell phone calls, it's not just that the Russians know and knew about the squeeze on the Ukrainian president months in advance. I think every intelligence service in the world would be guilty of malpractice if they weren't routinely listening in. And that means that not only Moscow, but Berlin, Ottawa, Paris, and many other capitals probably have tapes of calls that Trump has made. And my guess is we're not just talking about calls to Rudy Giuliani. We know that Trump made these calls to Putin and others from the Situation Room that were damaging enough that his aides decided to put them into a deep freeze, probably illegally, to keep them from being available to anybody. We know that the call with Zelensky that's become so significant here, that Republicans in the Judiciary Committee have been referring to as a transcript, was not a transcript. It's about 8 to 10 minutes of a 30-minute call, so they edited out a lot of stuff. And I just have to believe that Trump made phone calls to Putin, to MBS in Saudi Arabia, to Erdogan, very possibly to Kim in North Korea, maybe to Duterte in the Philippines, and who knows who else, on his cell phone because he didn't want anybody listening in. And I got to believe at some point, somebody is going to leak one or more of those tapes. And it may well be more likely to be one of our allies than one of our adversaries, because our adversaries are happy to keep Trump in office.
You know, it did occur to me this morning. I was writing about Trump's rather successful obstruction of Congress. It occurred to me that historians are going to know a lot more about Trump's conduct than we do now. And they're just going to be amazed at how much evidence was left on the table that we don't have, you know, because they're going to have access to these documents, emails, text messages, maybe, you know, tapes of phone calls, memoirs, transcripts that we haven't seen. So the question is whether we will see them in time. This is one of the reasons why I guess I have very mixed feelings about the Democrats' pace of impeachment, and I wanted to get your take on all of that. Because as of right now, I mean, they're going ahead. I'm among those who believe that there's more than sufficient evidence to impeach the president. On the other hand, Congress has not received a single document other than that partial readout of the readout of the July 25th phone call. There is so much else that is out there. And I guess part of me is thinking that the Democrats are being perhaps just a little hasty in moving ahead without pushing those subpoenas, at least testing what the courts are going to allow.
You know, I was talking with a very savvy Democrat today, this morning, who raised the same misgivings. I would say a couple of things that explain why Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats are moving forward more quickly. One is if you wait for the courts to play this out, and much of it can be slow walked for a significant period of time, you might end up going into March, April, May of next year. And the closer you get to the 2020 election, the more the idea that you're doing this to interfere in the election itself, the traction that Republicans can have to say, wait and let the election results decide it, takes hold. So there's a reason for moving forward. There's a reason for focusing on Ukraine and the obstruction of justice that comes from that. Because if you flood the zone with all of the things that Trump has done wrong, right, one of his great ironic strengths is that there are so many scandals that people just get unable to focus on any of the single outrages, and it dilutes the whole thing. The second reason,
I agree with that, by the way.
Yeah. The second reason is that, you know, Trump, of course, tweeted yesterday, move to the Senate, get this done quickly. And it's because, of course, he believes that with Mitch McConnell controlling the process, that they'll be able to call in all of these witnesses, as he mentioned, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, Adam Schiff, and so on. The other side of that is that when you move to a Senate trial, the managers from the House are going to have the ability to call their own witnesses and call for their own documents. And there you have an even greater amount of leverage because you've impeached the man. And that means they should be able to call as witnesses Mick Mulvaney, maybe Reince Priebus, who was there when all of those damaging phone calls were put into the deep secret archives in the national security bin. Rob Porter, who was around and saw an awful lot as a major figure in the White House. John Kelly, and maybe even Donald Trump himself. Now,
certainly John Bolton.
Much of the burden there is going to go, and John Bolton, of course, much of the burden there is going to fall on Chief Justice Roberts. And we will at that point get a picture about how independent he is in terms of calling for and demanding that that evidence, including the documentary evidence, be available to senators. Even the secret materials could be available to them in a skiff, as it were, the secret rooms. But there's another side to what witnesses you can call. And so I can understand why they're moving with dispatch. But you're absolutely right that there is a strong potential downside.
Well, and I do think that also one of the reasons maybe they can pursue this on two tracks, you know, move ahead on all of this, but still go to the courts and ask whether or not the courts are going to enforce these subpoenas. And there's some indication that they might be successful with a federal district court in federal district court judge ruling that Don McGahn did not have absolute immunity to not testify. But, you know, without testing it, one of the articles of impeachment will obviously be obstruction of Congress or obstruction of justice. And I don't think this can be emphasized strongly enough. You know, this obstruction is not a sideshow. It really is the heart of Trump's attack on constitutional norms. No president, not even Richard Nixon, has stonewalled or covered up as aggressively as Donald Trump. And I do think that whatever they can do to pressure that to go ahead and test the limits of this presidential power is worth doing. I mean, the Democrats, you know, Congress did not move toward the impeachment of Richard Nixon. I mean, well, they were moving toward it. But I mean, imagine if they had not waited for the Supreme Court to rule on whether or not the tapes needed to be released, the Nixon tapes. And of course, that was the decisive moment, was when the courts basically said the cover up was over and that Richard Nixon had to go. So I do think that a more aggressive legal strategy, if they can do that consistent with whatever political timetable they have, you know, all well and good. But at this point, speed is Donald Trump's friend. I mean, Donald Trump wants this to be over as quickly as possible, which tells me that those of us that want the strongest possible case against Trump might have a different timetable than he would have.
Now, that's certainly the case. I will say, as you talk about the Nixon tapes case, which was a unanimous decision, that Brett Kavanaugh, before he moved to the Supreme Court, gave speeches in which he suggested it maybe had been wrongly decided. So moving through the courts may not have the outcome that we desire. But having said that, there is no doubt that this blanket order from the president denying not only documents, but ordering everybody in the executive branch not to cooperate in any way is the most direct assault on the Constitution and its separation of powers and the role of Congress ever in the history of the country. And, you know, let's go back to the Nixon impeachment. No question that the tapes had a huge impact. The other thing that had a huge impact was learning about the tapes, which was the Senate committee where you had senators who cared about the Constitution and the facts, getting Alexander Butterworth to testify that there'd been a taping system. You had Howard Baker. You had Hugh Scott, the Republican leader, who put country over party. You had Fred Thompson, who did a fair job as the Republican counsel. You had Barry Goldwater, who stood for integrity at that point. Now I look at Mitch McConnell, who is no Hugh Scott. Find me a Howard Baker or a Fred Thompson or a Barry Goldwater. There isn't one of them who stood up, much less a single Republican in the House, for the integrity of their own institution or to protect the nature of the Constitution, the oath that they took. So I'm a little more uneasy about letting this play out with a belief that there will be some who understand that this is a direct threat to the fundamentals of our constitutional democracy.
Well, again, before we move on from Richard Nixon, you know, and as you know, he did obviously try to drag his feet and cover up the tapes. But unlike Donald Trump, he instructed his aides to cooperate with Congress. Otherwise, we would not have had that testimony. We would not have had the testimony of, you know, Ehrlichman and Haldeman and John Dean and, you know, the learned about the tapes. So that is a rather dramatic contrast. So and I think the strongest argument, and again, I would like them to slow their roll just a little bit, but the strongest argument, I think, for moving ahead expeditiously is the fact that this is basically an ongoing crime scene. That clearly the president has not been deterred. He's been was emboldened by his sense that he had gotten away with had skated after the Mueller report, that he had successfully obstructed justice in the Mueller report, and the fact that he has his personal attorney. I find this story just absolutely amazing, that even while this impeachment is going ahead, an impeachment that is looking into the president's attempts to get the Ukrainians to dig up dirt on his political rival, that even as this is moving forward, Rudy Giuliani, his personal attorney and representative, is in the Ukraine, is in Kyiv or Kiev, however you want to pronounce it, continuing to openly dig up dirt on Joe Biden. It is remarkable.
There's so much about Rudy Giuliani that's remarkable, and none of it in a good way. And of course, by continuing to operate as the president's personal attorney and to do his own tweets, which further implicate Trump directly in the quid pro quo pressure on President Zelensky to turn up dirt on Joe Biden. And as they said in the Judiciary Committee hearings, as we heard multiple times in the House Intelligence Committee hearings, the fact that what Trump wanted was not so much a real investigation as a public announcement that they were investigating that makes it clear that it was all about sliming Joe Biden, who he saw as his most formidable rival, that all of that is there. And I would add one other element that I think is crucial to all of this. All of this worked deeply to the advantage of Vladimir Putin and the interests of Russia against the national security interests of the United States. So it's not just about a president illegally and unconstitutionally using his powers as president to advance his own personal political interest. He was doing so at the to the detriment of American national security. And Rudy is just making this worse, but it's also characteristic of Trump and the people around him doubling down over and over again on wrongdoing. And it's why, Charlie, to go back to our earlier conversation, if this man wins re-election, what we've seen so far, the kleptocracy, using position in government for yourself and your family and your cronies to make money off the backs of the American population and the taxpayers, The kakistocracy, as I've said multiple times, that ancient word now brought back into use, which means government by the least and most unscrupulous among us. The corruption that we see at almost every department and the maladministration and the moves towards autocracy, all of that that's been so frightening now will be nothing compared to what we will see if he is unleashed with a re-election victory after all of this.
No, and I think this whole story illustrates that, that he made the phone call to Ukraine the day after Bob Mueller's rather unsuccessful testimony. And so he was emboldened by that. And you can imagine how he will be emboldened by, you know, the acquittal in the Senate and if he, in fact, is reelected, because then there is a president who is absolutely unshackled, who's made it clear that I believe that that he does think that he is above the law. And he has now assembled an administration that is willing to enable him. I mean, all the fantasies about surrounding him with adults in the room who would somehow restrain him. I mean, that's all gone now. I mean, look who he has surrounded himself with. Mike Pompeo, Bill Barr, a White House crew that feels that, you know, that not only will not restrain his worst impulses, but is going to find a way to actualize them. By the way, what I find fascinating about, you know, Rudy Giuliani, who's a good friend of yours, right? I mean, you and Rudy go way back.
I never made it onto Nixon's enemies list. But when Rudy Giuliani publicly a few weeks ago called me a bullshit artist and a nitwit, it made my month.
You should have that, you know, on a T-shirt. I have a human scum T-shirt. So, you know,
we're all in this fraternity together. You know, for a long time, I and others would marvel at the fact that the least corrupt member of the Trump cabinet was Rick Perry. And of course, then we found out that he was up to his elbows in the corruption in Ukraine, trying to get his cronies to basically do a takeover of their energy companies. But you look at this entire cabinet and you could not throw a pebble into a rogues gallery without hitting somebody who would fit the title of worst period, fill in the blank cabinet secretary period, ever period. But none at this point are as dangerous as Pompeo and especially Barr. And to imagine Bill Barr, just read the transcript or watch the speech that he gave to the Federalist Society, which will scare you to death if you believe in a Republican form of democracy and a constitution. Look at what he said just the other day, basically intimating that if groups in a city or a neighborhood criticize the police, that maybe they shouldn't get police protection, which is right out of an authoritarian playbook. And think about him in a second term. And then Pompeo, who, of course, we have this image indelibly etched of him smiling, joking, and laughing with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia in the immediate aftermath of the torture, death, and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Khashoggi, and who is now doing Putin's bidding every day. And it's just breathtaking.
You started off with a very dystopian view of what might happen if there's an election and Donald Trump won't leave. My dystopian fears of the future have to do with Bill Barr and his concept of the unitary executive, which basically is that the president can do anything that he wants under Article 2 powers. So, for example, let's imagine that this process is over, the president is reelected, and the Southern District of New York decides it's going to indict Rudy Giuliani on a host of charges, and President Trump just tweets out that he's ordering the Attorney General to drop all the charges against Rudy. Now everybody would say, "Well, that's shocking. That's, he can't do that." Well, Bill Barr would say, "Yes, he can do that." And what are you going to do about it? Because, you know, so many of these things are these norms. I mean, everybody, again, the conventional wisdom, you know, is that the Southern District of New York is absolutely independent. It's it would never, ever, ever, you know, be subject to that kind of political manipulation. Well, says who at this point?
You're exactly right. And Barr would, I think, fire all of the people who are working in the Southern District or reassign them to horrible places to push them out. You look what's happened to the diplomatic corps, first under Rex Tillerson and now with a meat axe taken by Mike Pompeo. You look at what's happened to any evidence-based, science-based research and component of the federal government, where, for example, Sonny Perdue in the Agriculture Department basically dismantled their scientific apparatus because he didn't like it. You think about what Barr would do in the Civil Rights Division and the Voting Rights Division and the Public Integrity Section, as well as the Southern District. You think about what judges that they put in would do if state courts or state attorneys general in New York or elsewhere brought their own charges against Trump, against Giuliani or others, and they would find ways to say that it's unconstitutional or inappropriate for them to bring those prosecutions forward. And you think about how unleashed Trump would feel with the backing of his attorney general to engage in the kind of kleptocracy and theft that we've already seen with his enterprises and, in effect, selling pieces of America's national interest to protect his own hotels and casinos and other properties, and to do the same with his cronies. And, you know, you can take dystopian and move it to a very new and very disturbing level.
Well, you know, there was a period, I don't know whether we're still hearing it, when the conventional wisdom had decided that, well, okay, Trump is a threat, but our institutions have proven their resiliency. We have this system of checks and balances, and we have other, you know, institutions that are still standing strong. And quite frankly, I still think that's naive because of just what we've been describing, because how much of that independence, the institutional independence, is based on those informal norms that are about to be shattered. And if, in fact, this scenario that we're playing with right now, rather darkly, I'm sorry to depress our listeners here, you know, plays out, the, you know, role of Congress as providing oversight and or a check on the executive will have been absolutely shredded. And going back to this obstruction of justice, obstruction of Congress, if the president takes the position that he doesn't have to answer congressional inquiries, he doesn't have to turn over documents, he doesn't have to make anyone in the executive branch available for testimony, what does that do for the system of checks and balances? It becomes a dead letter. And we know that a Republican Congress won't even attempt it. But if he pursues this, he can basically shrug off even a Democratic House of Representatives that tries to check his executive power.
So you are, of course, spot on. So my longtime colleague and writing partner, Tom Mann, and I did a book in 2006 called The Broken Branch about Congress. Mm. We did a book in 2012 called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. And we revised it with a paperback edition and 2 years later called It's Even Worse Than It Was. But the underlying theme in all of those books is very much along the lines of what you've been talking about. You can have a constitution, you can have laws, you can have rules in place as they do in Congress, but it's all built around having the norms
right
that operate, and that having people who respect the norms, who respect the fact that if you lose, you lose, that the rules have to be fair to make that happen, that you operate within that set of rules, and that you respect the institutions of which you are a part. And while this started with in 2006, we really hit both parties for their role in beginning to break the norms and moving away from what, you know, we wonks about Congress call the regular order. By 2012, we focused much more on Mitch McConnell and the Republican Party, which we called an insurgent outlier. Mm-hmm. And now that's happened even more. And I'll take just one example, as you talked about oversight, and which, you know, has dismayed me. So Lamar Alexander, whom I've known for a very long time and viewed as one of the most, you know, model public servants of his generation and more, governor of Tennessee, secretary of education, longtime senator, now retiring, and has been the chair of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the HELP Committee in the Senate, which has jurisdiction over the Department of Education, the Department of Labor, the Department of Health and Human Services. Think about what's happened in the Department of Education over the last 2.5 years. The people put in charge of the student loan program, of the private universities program, those who had been themselves either under investigation for wrongdoing when they were involved in those activities, or who had come right out of them directly, and who have done nothing except create more scandals and corruption in the student loan program, in the private schools program. Think about the Department of Health and Human Services, which has had jurisdiction over the private entities, including private prisons like the GEO Group, that have established the places where the asylum seekers and refugees have been put when they've come to try and seek asylum. And of course, what we've seen is not just child separation, but horrible mistreatment that has included deaths and just, you know, unspeakable things. Find me any oversight hearings in that committee since Trump became president about any of these issues or problems to try and put some constraints around them. Find me an instance where they have voted down in the Senate any of the nominees who lied to the Senate, as Scott Pruitt did pretty clearly before he was confirmed as the head of EPA, and of course then ended up going down in scandal, with judges who have been unanimously ruled as unqualified by the American Bar Association and who have no credentials to be judges. We have seen no check and balance, no advice and consent that is meaningful, no oversight, and that's made things that much worse. And it is with people, you know, it's one thing to say, well, look, they don't want a primary challenge because they've been disloyal to the president, or, well, he'll become a lobbyist and needs clients. That's not true of Lamar Alexander. It's not true of many of them. And it's because I believe, to put it bluntly, we're talking about something that's become more like a cult than a party. Yeah. And the fear of being excommunicated, of being shunned, and you know this well, mm-hmm. It's a damaging thing. Either you stand up with some moral backbone and character and say, if that's what's going to happen, I still got to be have the integrity to do what's right. Jeff Flake suffered from that very clearly. Or you cave. And they've all caved. And it's just remarkable to me and so dispiriting.
Well, it is remarkable to me. And we have talked about that extensively. Okay, so Norm, I want to get your take on sort of switching gears here on the state of the Democratic race, because it seems to be incredibly in flux right now, especially with the news this week. So I want to get your take. And again, you know, what this field looks like after Kamala Harris's departure. But first, here's a word from our sponsor. You know, the week after Christmas brings the heaviest caseload for police in some areas. Break-ins spike every year during the holidays because families are traveling, burglars know people have expensive stuff, gifts lying around. What's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have any home security, probably because most companies don't make it easy. Other systems can be difficult to use, long-term contracts full of hidden fees, astronomical monthly fees. But SimpliSafe is my choice for home security. In fact, I just installed it in the last couple of weeks. It's comprehensive, professional home security at a really fair price. And right now is the best time of year to get the SimpliSafe security system. For the holidays, you get a huge discount on your security system and a free security camera. It was amazingly easy to set this system up around my house. And I have to say, even though I have 3 dogs, I can sleep much safer and more comfortably knowing that this system is in place. It protects every room, door, and window with 24/7 professional monitoring. If there's a break-in, SimpliSafe can give real-time video confirmation so police can respond up to 3.5 times faster. With SimpliSafe, there's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. Prices are fair and they're honest, starting at just $15 a month. So go to simplisafe.com/bulwark now to take advantage of SimpliSafe's amazing holiday savings and get a free HD security camera. This offer is for a limited time only, and it's ending soon, so really you ought to hurry. That's simplisafe.com/bulwark to save big and get a free security camera. simplisafe.com/bulwark. Okay, we are back with Norm Orenstein from the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor to The Atlantic. So give me your take, Norm, on where the Democratic race is. Any quick thoughts on why Kamala Harris, who was supposed to be one of the top-tier candidates, I think was number one in CNN's power rating at one time, why her campaign flamed out?
So, you know, we could point to many reasons. And of course, everything that happened, once you drop out, you can use as a reason for it. It clearly was not a very well organized campaign. It clearly did not have that sort of thematic approach that could make you stand out as a candidate. I think when Harris made the decision in an early debate, which gave her some additional attention, to go after Joe Biden directly and frontally on the busing issue, that she suffered a serious backlash. And it was not just a backlash for attacking Biden, but when she came out with her own position on busing subsequently, it wasn't very far removed from his own. Plus the fact that there are just a whole lot of other candidates. And I think, as some have suggested, it may be very tough for a black woman. I was saddened to see her drop out, I must say. And part of the reason, Charlie, is that I have a very strong interest in policies that deal with mental illness. I lost a son 5 years ago, this coming January 3rd, after a 10-year struggle with serious mental illness. He had no awareness, no insight into his own illness. That's part of the brain disease. Mm. And we have despicable and terrible policies for those with serious mental illness. And Kamala Harris did a really good job coming up with a solid policy just days before she dropped out. But that aside, if you have so many candidates, so only so much money out there that can go to those candidates, you need money to be able to organize and keep a campaign afloat. And if you don't have any sense of momentum, or you don't have that handle that brings people behind you when there are other rivals for those things, otherwise intriguing or qualified candidates struggle. We're seeing the same phenomenon now with Cory Booker, who has some very strong credentials out there compared to other candidates. But who may not be able to make it on the next debate stage. And if you're not on the debate stage, it's like you're a non-person. And if you are, even with 10 other candidates, you may not be able to make it. But let's face it, the winnowing out process has winnowed out some, but we now have others jumping in. And there are a couple of larger points I would make here. We have Michael Bloomberg and Deval Patrick parachuting into this race because they believe that Joe Biden is just going to fade to obscurity, and that there is an opening in this lane for somebody in the center left as opposed to the left left. And I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical in part because I think Joe Biden's support is steady and pretty solid, and that the people who support Biden, in part because he was the number two to a black man as a white man, has that attachment to Obama, in part because of his depth of experience, in part because of his own family history and the empathy that he brings, they're not going to be swayed by a few gaffes or even some debate performances that are not up to par. And the common wisdom, which I see all over Twitter and on cable television, that people are dissatisfied, Democrats are dissatisfied with their candidates, the support for the top four, which is 75 to 80% of all the Democrats, which is Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and Pete Buttigieg, is pretty strong and ardent. And what that suggests to me is we could go with a set of rules that don't have winner take all anywhere, that often have just a 15% threshold for delegate support, all the way through Super Tuesday and beyond, with nobody taking a significant or commanding lead. And we could have, for the first time in since the 1950s, a convention that goes beyond a single ballot. And people say, oh, a broker convention, really? There are no brokers. There aren't people who move those delegates around. And we could end up with a very potentially even chaotic situation.
Well, I'm in Milwaukee right now, so that would be very entertaining for us here in Wisconsin. Well, Karl Rove has a piece where he predicts that it's going to go right to the convention, and the numbers, for the reasons that you mentioned, you know, make that certainly plausible, the fact that you don't have winner take all. So I was making a list earlier this week, though, of the centrist candidates. That seems to me that there was a moment in the Democratic race where there was an intake of breath, and people, when it looked like that Elizabeth Warren was surging, and people said, do we really want to go in that direction? And as a result, you have an amazing, you know, field of, I would say, center left candidates. I mean, you know, you have obviously Biden at the top of that list, Buttigieg, who's decided he wants to get into that lane. Bullock was running there. He's out now. But Cory Booker, Deval Patrick, Amy Klobuchar is still there, hanging in there. Bloomberg got in specifically to be the centrist savior. Senator Bennett is still in this race from Colorado. But I guess your point, though, is they're all waiting on Biden to fade. And one of the perhaps undercovered stories has been Joe Biden just persists, right? He's just motoring on. And everybody keeps waiting for, you know, him to implode or his eye to explode on national television again. And he didn't. And I don't think that him blowing up at the voter in Iowa yesterday was a net negative. You know, I think it made him look kind of feisty.
I don't think it will hurt him with the people who support him. And I also think, you know, he's naturally very sensitive to allegations about his son, Hunter. Remember that when Joe was 29, before he got sworn into the Senate, there was this horrible accident. Truck hit the car with his wife and three children. One died. The two and his wife died. The two boys, Hunter and Beau, were in the hospital for months. Then you go through years where you have a single father tied to Washington. I watched this up close. Joe would leave the Senate at 6 p.m. on a lot of days, even when there was a lot of stuff going on, to take the train back to Delaware to be with his kids. Then you have the tragedy of Beau, the rising star in the Biden family, getting brain cancer and dying. And you've got Hunter having been through all of that and having deep, deep flaws, drug addiction, issues with mental illness, highly questionable judgment, issues over sex. But this is his son who's been through a huge and horrible amount. And Joe's going to be very protective. And that could be an issue for him, as others are going to prod him on this to try and get him to explode. But I think also most families have had difficulties, tragedies, problems in their family life. Here's a man who's seen more than most and who has an enormous amount of empathy. And I think that's going to be an anchor for him more than it is a problem for him.
This is a very interesting point you're making, because I'm trying to phrase this. You're part of the kind of the evil genius or the evil cunning of Donald Trump's focusing on Hunter Biden is not only that he can smear Biden, that Ukraine could have been the equivalent of the Hillary's emails. He knows that this is Joe Biden's most emotionally vulnerable point. Now, a more decent opponent would say, okay, you know what? I'm not going there. I'm not going after your kids. I know the pain you've gone through. I know how vulnerable you are emotionally, having lost these children, and this is your last remaining son. I wouldn't do that. But Donald Trump, and this is one of the distinctive, you know, characteristics of him, he goes for that. He has that bully's instinct to go for the one really area, the raw wound. And this is a raw wound for Joe Biden. And I frankly think this is part of their calculation, that they think that they can short circuit him, that he will have some sort of an emotional meltdown. But I also think that your point is on target. The assumption that that quote unquote emotional reaction is going to work against Joe Biden, I think may be a mistake on their part.
You know, most people who are parents have had issues with their children.
Yeah.
There are plenty of instances where your children don't do what you want them to do, or in other instances where your children turn out to be just like you, as I think we see with some of Donald Trump's children, adult children. But people know that parenting is an inexact thing and that you can't judge children entirely by your own actions. And I think that can work to his advantage. Now, you know, whether Biden develops more self-discipline on the trail, you know, he's run before and not done well as president. I'm not sure that he has prepared himself appropriately for debates. But if I were guessing today, if I were going to pick a front runner, foolish as that is at this stage of a wild and crazy campaign, it would still be Biden, and I'm very dubious, unless he does something far, far worse than we could imagine at this point, that support is just going to melt away. Now, having said that, we know that there is a struggle in the Democratic Party now across many wings. It was perhaps inevitable. But having said that, you know, you look at the focus that's there in much of the press on Congress, for example. And it's on the squad. It's on AOC and Omar and those four freshmen. There was a very large Democratic class of freshmen, and far, far more of them, many of them, of course, elected in highly vulnerable districts that were that went for Trump or red, are on the in the center or couple instances, center right. And you have people like Abigail Spanberger and Alyssa Slotkin, who served in the military or in our intelligence forces, a substantial number of them, who far outnumber those who are over on the left. You have more presidential candidates, and you gave a pretty impressive list of them, who are not where Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders are. You know, on a whole host of issues, Elizabeth Warren was not way over on the left. She sort of chose some of these positions because she saw her route to nomination being to outflank and overcome Bernie Sanders. But it's a different order than we see on the Republican side. And that's why, you know, I used the phrase very early on of asymmetric polarization. It's not clear where the Democrats are going to go. What is clear is that Warren's stock, which went way up, and it looked like she was on a clear path to a nomination, has stalled some now over the issue of Medicare for All and the way in which she's handled it, that she will have a core of support and Bernie Sanders will. I'm very doubtful that that will make up a majority of those Democrats who are voting when we move further on, including when we move down to South Carolina and over to Nevada and then through the Super Tuesday. And while we may end up with no clear favorite for the nomination, I could just as easily see a path even for a Pete Buttigieg as the sort of new young face. And the fact that those on the left are attacking him so vigorously now, see that challenge. So we could end up with a Democratic nominee who's, you know, going to be pretty strong. Having said that, it's also important to remember that there will be at least $2 billion spent plus an additional equivalent in rubles to slime whoever the Democratic nominee is. And given the nature of the Electoral College and where voters are, we can't say anything about what will happen in November of 2020.
Yeah, I mean, and right now, the Republicans are able to run an electoral college strategy while the Democrats are still fighting for votes in states that will not be in play in November. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Norm Orenstein, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today on the Bulwark Podcast.
It was really my pleasure, and I admire the positions that you've taken and your willingness to be out there and out front in what you do, Charlie.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Simply Safe. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.